Laguna Niguel, Laguna Beach, KX93.5.
This disclaimer is a statement notifying the listening audience that the opinions expressed on any public affairs show do not reflect those of KX93.5, its management, or the board of directors.
You are listening to a special edition of Laguna Roundtable. As a reflection of the commitment of KX93.5 to ensure that the views and the policies of those that seek to represent us are known, the station and Jason Fetty, host of Full English Breakfast, have provided Laguna Roundtable with the time on the first Sunday of each month so that we can bring to you additional broadcasts of special interviews. For that, we are extremely grateful. We hope and trust you'll find these broadcasts valuable and informative. Thank you for listening. Good morning, Laguna Beach, Orange County, and to all our friends joining us today. Coming to you from the heart of the village in beautiful Laguna Beach, California, you're listening to Laguna Roundtable, with smart talk and bold perspectives. Brought to you by your Laguna Roundtable co-hosts, Jim Kennedy and Dr. Ari Grayson on KX93.5. Welcome to Laguna Roundtable. I'm Ari Grayson. I'd like to welcome my guest today, Mike Levin, candidate for California's 49th U.S. Congressional District. Mike is challenging a Republican incumbent, Daryl Issa. I've been looking forward to our conversation, Mike, so welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ari. It's great to be here.
The incumbent, Daryl Issa, has been serving the U.S. Congress representing Southern California for 14 years. The 49th Congressional District runs along the coast from Dana Point to Del Mar and includes South Orange County and Northern San Diego County. Given that Daryl Issa and his handlers have declined to respond to invitations to appear here on Laguna Roundtable and to share his views with the people he presumably represents.
Shocking.
Yeah. Who would have guessed? I would like to discuss some of the issues that are of importance to Southern California and to the nation. And I'd also like to look at some of Daryl Issa's voting record and how you might represent the 49th Congressional District, either the same or perhaps differently.
I think it might be a little different.
It may well be. Well, you know, why don't we do this then? Let's begin with you telling our listeners just a little bit about yourself and why you decided to take this challenge on and run for the U.S. House of Representatives.
Well, thanks again for the opportunity to appear, Ari. You know, I am from South Orange County. I went to public schools in South Orange County, ultimately went off to Stanford University for undergrad, became student body president my junior year. My senior year began to get very active in Democratic and progressive politics, working on Bill Bradley's campaign and then Al Gore's campaign. And eventually did something called a Coro Fellowship, Public Service Fellowship. And I was really hooked working on political campaigns and really interested in the policy as well. Eventually went to law school, went to Duke University in North Carolina, worked on some more campaigns there, and got back and had the great honor to be the executive director of the Democratic Party of Orange County back in 2006 and 2007. And I saw the importance of grassroots political organizing. Eventually, I had to pay off all my law school loans, so I went and became a practicing attorney working for a firm called Brian Cave for a number of years, and then ultimately went in-house to two clean energy companies. The one I'm currently at is called Fuel Cell Energy, and I'm their West Coast person doing a variety of government and regulatory and legal work. And I have loved my time in clean energy. I serve on three clean energy nonprofit boards, helped to start the Clean Energy Trade Association in Orange County. And, you know, everything was very, very good, got very active on the presidential campaign. When I saw Donald Trump was, you know, very likely going to be the nominee of the Republican Party, I felt then, as I do now, that in many ways he's an existential threat to our democracy. And it's very personal for me when I hear about Donald Trump's rhetoric or see who he surrounds himself with. On one side of the family, I'm Jewish. You'd probably guess that. But on the other side, my grandparents were Mexican immigrants. You may not know that by looking at me or by seeing the last name Levin. But on my mom's side, my grandpa and grandma came from Mexico. They had five daughters, all of whom wound up going to college, two public school teachers. One ran the Boys and Girls Club in Palm Springs. One became an attorney, and my mom became the first female toy designer at Mattel. Contrast that with my grandparents, who had really no formal education, didn't even graduate from high school. But when my grandpa became an American citizen at age 50, it was the proudest day of his life. On the other side of the family, as I mentioned, Jewish immigrants. My grandpa fought in World War II, came back from the Army Air Force, and he and my grandma started a small carpet and drapery business, but couldn't use the last name Levin my last name because in the 1950s in Los Angeles, there was a fair amount of anti-Semitism after World War II. So that was the great irony. My grandpa fought Nazi Germany, came back, couldn't use his own last name in business, so he went by the last name Dean in business for the rest of his life. I think that he would look at the recent events in our country, specifically in Charlottesville, and really the tone and tenor of the Trump administration, many of his supporters. I think he would be ashamed for our country in many ways. The refusal to proudly stand against intolerance of all forms, hatred and division. I think what made America great in the first place was acceptance for our differences, not merely tolerance. So every day as I'm running, Ari, I'm thinking of them. And I'm also thinking of my two young kids. I have a 5-year-old and a 3-year-old. My wife and I are residents and homeowners in San Juan Capistrano. And it's been just a great honor of a lifetime to be able to run and get to know so many people in our community and see, you know, we're doing certain things very well in our community, but there's a lot of people that are really struggling to make ends meet. We've got a pretty low unemployment rate, but we have a significant underemployment rate, and we need an economy that works better for everyone. And frankly, it's working well if you're one of the very wealthiest in our society, like Daryl Issa, wealthiest member of Congress, like President Trump, wealthiest president in our history. But if you're not super rich, might not be working as well for you.
Well, it's interesting that as you're speaking, what I'm hearing is a connection that is not only historical. By the connection, I mean your personal narrative, the history of your grandparents immigrating to the United States, the contemporary, where you see things are now, and the future, where you'd like things to be for your children. My personal narrative is very similar to yours. Some of my family came from Eastern Europe. They went into the garment industry, as so many people did. They didn't have any formal college education, but the next generation got a college education, very often just a bachelor's degree. But typically then we see people moving on to such as yourself or myself, where you went to law school. I have a number of attorneys in my family as well. But my wife and I, also second generation in this country, both have our PhDs. But seeing what's happening now, seeing what our forebears did in coming to this country to struggle to make it and to achieve the American dream, to give that dream over to their children and grandchildren, and to see what's happening now where we've got this fear of immigrants, where historically we have always recognized that immigrants and immigration is our strength.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And look, we have to have a pathway to citizenship. For people whose only problem is the status of their documentation, if they're otherwise productive citizens, which virtually all immigrants in our society are contributing positively to our economy, to our country, to our state. We know that in California, there's no question in my mind that we need to advance a path to citizenship rather than try as Donald Trump and Jeff Sessions and others have discussed, deport people by the millions. For me, it's fundamentally un-American and flies in the face of everything that brought my grandfather and grandmother here in the first place from Mexico and from Eastern Europe, fleeing persecution in Europe on the other side of the family. So we have to get back to what made America great in the first place.
Absolutely. You had mentioned you're an environmental attorney. You're a business leader in the growing green technology, clean energy industry. So I wanted to ask you a few questions about the potential for this industry, not only from an environmental standpoint, but also what that means to our economy and job creation, because it seems to me that the future of our nation rests in the development of these kinds of green technologies. So what would you like to see Congress do moving forward to ensure that California is a major hub of green technology and the renewable energy industry with all of the jobs and the well-paying jobs that that would provide?
Well, we need to make America generally and California specifically the clean energy superpower of the 21st century. And we need to get the good paying jobs that go along with it because, look, it's going to be China or Europe or us. But I think we're starting to get it, across the country and here in our district, we have cities, many of them with Republican leaders that are stepping up to boost clean energy and energy efficiency. They know it's good for the economy. They know it's good for public health. And I think we need to learn from the success we've had here in California and realize that if we do invest in clean energy technology, it'll lead to significant economic growth. You know, there's studies out there showing that in California alone, we have over 500,000 clean energy jobs. You contrast that in the entire country, there's about 50,000 coal jobs. So literally, the clean energy industry just in California is 10 times greater than the entirety of the coal industry. So several things that I think we need to do in Washington. First is extend tax credits for renewable energy technologies. The second is we have to end subsidies to the oil and fossil fuel companies, and that means we don't rig the game in favor of fossil fuels compared to more sustainable sources. And then we need to lay out a number of options to reduce carbon emissions. You know, pulling out of the Paris Climate Accord, I felt was a disgrace. We went from a leader to a laughingstock. So I'd like to see a national renewable portfolio standard. I'd like to see some sort of revenue-neutral carbon tax, which is sometimes called cap and dividend, where you put a price on carbon pollution, but you return the revenue that's generated to taxpayers to offset rising energy costs. So I think there are a lot of bipartisan solutions out there. I'm very fortunate that in my career I've worked on the state and federal level to get Republican support and plenty of Democratic support to get clean energy legislation passed. I'd be prepared to hit the ground running on day one and do that for the residents of our district.
It would certainly seem to me that clean air is a nonpartisan issue. Most of my Republican friends like to breathe.
They like to breathe, too, and they probably saved a lot of years to be able to buy a beautiful coastal home here in Laguna Beach, and they don't want that investment going underwater, literally, with sea level rise, or they don't want dirty air. They don't want a dirty beach. I mean, these are not partisan issues, and I think we can reach out across the aisle and get a lot of more eco-friendly people, regardless of their party affiliation.
Right. You know, and I've always said I try to keep the bar on my day set fairly low. I like to wake up in the morning, breathe clean air, knowing that it's not going to cause lung cancer.
Yep.
I'd like to go for a swim or a nice dip in the ocean with the knowledge that I can do so without having tumors all over my body.
Yep.
You know, I like to know that the food in the food chain is not going to cause cancer.
Yep.
You know, silly me. What was I thinking? But in the spirit of that, one of the things that a lot of Californians are concerned about is that the Trump administration is going to try to open up the coastal waters of our state to oil drilling.
Yes. And ISIS supports that.
Well, and we did see the accident up in, or the spill up
in Santa Barbara.
About a year and a half, 2 years ago.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's any lingering effects to their beach, but we know the stress and the turmoil that that created at the time.
Yep.
Now, it seems that San Onofre, being in your congressional district,
yep,
that is technically a renewable, well, not a renewable energy source, but it doesn't emit any carbon.
Well, here's the problem is when they originally created San Onofre, just like all the other nuclear plants in California and elsewhere, there was supposed to be a permanent repository for the waste or for the spent fuel that was going to be created by virtue of the reaction. But unfortunately, that permanent repository, Yucca Mountain, in which our country invested over $40 billion, was closed in 2010. A lot of that had to do with the power of Harry Reid as majority leader not wanting to see the spent fuel in Nevada. So we're left with a circumstance that was unintended, which is we did operate San Onofre not quite as long as we would have liked or as long as would have been designed, but now we've got a big, big problem on our hands. And I've actually visited the site, toured it. I had to
move away from
Exactly. Well, I had to go through a radioactivity Geiger counter type of thing at the end to make sure that, you know, I wasn't fluorescent. But
well, that's emotionally reassuring.
Yeah. Well, I have incredible respect for the people that do work there on a daily basis to clean up the site, decommission the site. You know, the problem as I see it is you've got 3,000 fuel assemblies, each of which is, you know, big. It's 14 feet tall. It's got a significant, you know, harmful effect. If anybody were to touch it, you would die. And it's going to be toxic to humans for many thousands of years. And right now it's, you know, many of these fuel assemblies, literally a couple thousand of them, are sitting in a massive pool, spent fuel pool. And there are some that want to keep them in the pool pending the permanent solution that we've discussed, permanent repository. And then there are others that want to move those assemblies to what they call dry cask storage. Now, that in effect is You take a number of those fuel assemblies and you put them in a cylinder and you fill it with helium. You shut it off. It's a kind of a stainless steel cylinder. You weld it shut and then you bury it and then you pour concrete on it. Now, the problem with that is, by Edison's own admission, it is experimental. So I've spoken with people at Edison. I've spoken with people that are suing Edison. I've spoken with people that are concerned here in Laguna Beach and really up and down our coast. What I know is that I think I have the technical know-how, I have the relationships, the legal background to be able to go in again on day one and try to deliver something for our district. We have to get the waste out of there safely and quickly. There are a number of bills that are floating out there in Congress right now. ICE has got one that's uniformly disliked by all sides because it really doesn't do much. It benefits this company in Texas that bankrolled Rick Perry's political rise. But, you know, there are options for that waste. One of them is reopening Yucca Mountain in Nevada, and that would take some time and money, a lot of money. And depending on who you ask, it could be 20 or 30 or 40 years before it's ready to take the type of canisters that we're using at San Onofre. Another option is the Palo Verde nuclear plant in Arizona. Now, that's intriguing because it's actually 1/6 owned by Southern California Edison. So there are some that think that it could be railed, you know, over there on the rail line. And it's fairly close to the I-10 outside of Phoenix, about 50 miles outside of Phoenix. Another option is what they call consolidated interim storage. There are a variety of potential places it could go under that arrangement, one of which is New Mexico. The governor of New Mexico, Susana Martinez, has said that she wouldn't be opposed, in fact, would welcome the jobs, the economic opportunity of being a repository for the waste. There's another site in Utah. And then lastly is that site in Texas that our pal Daryl Issa favors with the company that's been fined for health and safety violations more than any other. So look, one way or the other, we have to fix this problem. You literally could not have a checklist of a worse place for nuclear waste than San Onofre.
We are certainly here in Orange County, a county which has always been a very strong base of support for Ronald Reagan. And I think many of our listeners may not be aware, but San Onofre was brought online during President Reagan's time. At that point, he was governor of the state of California.
Right.
That's when San Onofre was brought online.
Well, it's interesting you bring that up, Ari. So the first reactor, 1968, came online, and then it was decommissioned in the early 90s. The 2 and 3, reactors 2 and 3, those are the twin domes that we know today.
Okay.
Those were online in 82 and 83. Now, they decommissioned the first one in 92 or 93, and that left that piece of land. And that's where currently they're putting the dry cask storage, because it's a heck of a lot easier to put that there than actually have to remediate that site of Reactor 1. So, the history of this plant has not always been so good.
It does seem a bit checkered, but okay. So to put this in a little bit of context, in 1979, I believe it was late March or early April, we had the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. My sister lived within the 10-mile limit. She was 5 miles for her office, which was a mental health office, which closed in order to evacuate the city. She left not knowing whether she was ever going to be able to return to her home again. She had all of her family heirlooms, jewelry, so forth, as well as, a small family of cats and so forth. Shortly after that, this was now as the 1980 presidential race was really gearing up. Ronald Reagan said that nuclear energy is safer than solar energy. Now, you have to...
He tore the solar panels off the White House roof, as I recall.
Well, he did. That was one of his first acts because he felt that it showed weakness. But his rationale, and you really have to follow me on this, his rationale was that nobody had actually died at Three Mile Island. But we should always be mindful of the fact that if we have a proliferation of solar panels on people's roofs, people will have to go up to their roof to clean off their panels occasionally, and how many people will slip, fall, and break their skull cleaning their solar panels. So therefore, solar energy is more dangerous than nuclear energy. So there's a certain that's a historical reference that I don't know that any of our listeners would understand. But what do you feel is the correct approach then to ensuring that we have the energy resources that we need, that we have the energy independence that is required of us as a nation, and should wildlife be a consideration when it comes to having the energy necessary to drive our economy?
So we need to aspire to 100% renewable energy. And, you know, I'm a big fan of Stanford professor Mark Jacobson, his work. He's touted the concept of wind, water, and solar and introduced a scenario where we get all of our energy from those sources. You know, some people have looked at Professor Jacobson's work and felt that it's a little bit, you know, forward-thinking in the sense that you do need some carbon for some period of time. But virtually every study that I've read says that an 80% decarbonization is realistic and could be achieved at reasonable cost with, you know, widespread deployment of solar, of wind, along with a lot of storage, the electric vehicle infrastructure, and then you would have a supporting transmission infrastructure as well. In terms of wildlife, we always should be thinking of protecting wildlife. So, you know, good siting of renewable energy projects is really, really important. We always have to be thinking about biological diversity. But, you know, I always am mindful that reducing global warming pollution, that also has really important implications for wildlife also. So there's always a balancing act.
Well, it is. I mean, we've all seen images of polar bears that are drowning because the ice floes are so far from one another now that they have a hard time getting from point A to point B across the open waters. So you're right. You know, if we continue on this path where we're introducing so much CO2 into our atmosphere, that global warming persists, we're ultimately going to destroy the animal population and the ecosystems along
precisely with
the human population. So we can't escape that connection with one another. My next question is this. Daryl Issa voted to pass a bill that repeals and reduces financial regulations from the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act. Donald Trump has proclaimed that for every new regulation, two existing regulations should be repealed. So does reducing regulations provide us with a good solution? But what are the implications to the public if we continue on this policy of two-for-one repeal?
Well, you know, it's funny you bring it up. So a little earlier today, I got an email from ISA because I'm on his, you know, email list, and he actually was touting the fact that they had cut 16 regulations for every new regulation that they had created. And when I see it, I think, look, first, these are public protections, okay? They're there for a reason. You know, the Republicans in Congress have called for an immediate elimination of protections from the FDA, the EPA, Securities and Exchange Commission. And we have to think, what would be eliminated? We're talking, as you say, I mean, look, these are protections against cancerous poisons in food that are against drugs that now are going to be untested for their safety. Drinking water that's no longer going to be safe for consumption. This is to protect us from air pollutants that are going to get into our lungs and can't get out, from people that are fraudulently selling and trading stock, from lenders that are, you know, lending money in an unscrupulous fashion. So these are protections for the public that are important and necessary, and we need to stand up for protections. And I think the more people realize what the Republicans are trying to do under the guise of trying to get these regulations out of government. Well, and the reality is that these are public protections that matter in people's lives, that improve and enhance the quality of our lives, and without which we are worse off as a society. So I want them to stop lying about it.
As I mentioned to you as we were chatting just before coming on air, I'm somewhat of a Groucho Marxist. And when it comes to regulations, I think it's an appropriate application here. And one of Groucho's famous sayings was, they may be honest, but it helps to watch them.
Yeah.
And that's truly what regulations are designed to do. Businesses are responsible not to the general public, ultimately. They're responsible to their stockholders, their investors.
Well, and Daryl Issa, all he cares about is the top 0.1% of the population that are as rich as he is. In that regard, he's very much like the President of the United States. And there's this faux populism that Trump tried to promote during the campaign. Right. But just take a look at what he's doing, not what he's saying, and you'll see where his real heart is.
Well, and we've certainly seen that in the last couple of months. I just want to remind everyone you're listening to Laguna Roundtable on KX93.5 FM. I'm Dr. Ari Grayson. My guest today, Mike Levin, is a candidate for California's 49th U.S. Congressional District. On May 23rd, the White House unveiled a budget that would slash Medicaid by more than $800 billion over the next decade. The proposed Trump budget also takes aim at programs for food assistance, crop subsidies, education, and job training. The budget does include an increase of $54 billion for the military and elimination of the estate tax, which I'm sure, no doubt, Congressman Issa would be very grateful to receive.
Yep.
What is your position on these spending priorities, and what should be done to ensure that we have a national economy that is fiscally solvent?
Well, look, this budget is a disaster. And at its core, it's just big tax cuts for the wealthy and benefit cuts for the poor and working class. It's totally at odds with the supposed populism of Trump's campaign. It does favor defense, but it slashes most everything else, especially the safety net programs that keep millions of Americans, including many of those people who were conned by Trump and voted for him, right out of poverty. And if this budget passes, it's going to put so many Americans into poverty. I was particularly troubled by the very deep cuts in Medicaid, as you said, nutrition and housing services, medical research, education, even air traffic control. And when I look at the 49th District and the makeup of our district, in particular the cuts to the National Institutes of Health, the Department of Energy, the EPA, and HUD, they're all going to have a negative impact. The NIH cuts, that could have a profound impact. We get $800 million a year in NIH funding in our district alone. And all of that, you know, or a huge chunk of that could be in danger. We need every dollar we get from HUD to combat homelessness. Greater San Diego area, and the district is three-quarters San Diego County, it has the fourth highest per capita rate of homelessness in the United States. Only New York, Los Angeles, Seattle, those are the only three with higher per capita homelessness. Yet San Diego only receives the 22nd most per capita in HUD spending because of the formula that they use to deliver the HUD money. So this would put a $7 billion cut in the amount of HUD funding for housing. And even worse is that the person who's administering HUD under Dr. Ben Carson, who's not, last I checked, a housing expert, is actually, and I encourage your guests to look, or your listeners to look this up, is the wedding planner of Ivanka and Jared and of Donald and Melania. Literally the wedding planner of their wedding is in charge of how HUD money gets spent. I'm serious now. Google it. So look, the other thing is it's a giveaway to the big polluters. And at a time where we need to clean up our air and water, this is just a giveaway to the Koch brothers and to big oil at the expense of a cleaner environment. So I think at the end of the day, you know, I heard Darrell Issa. I was at his town hall in San Juan Capistrano. And he claimed that the budget was a rough draft, his words, and that he was going to fight for the district. And so far, he's demonstrated absolutely no capability to fight for much of anything other than whatever Donald Trump tells him to do.
You can certainly call it a rough draft, but it's always a reflection of what your values and your priorities are.
Right.
When you're increasing military spending by $54 billion,
right,
but you're cutting the State Department, when we have an incident like we're seeing now with the nation of North Korea,
yep,
you don't have the diplomatic mechanisms in place in order to try and tamp down the hostile languages, or the hostile language on both sides.
Yep,
you know there's something fundamentally wrong because it's carrying you down a path to war, which is not only costly in terms of human life, it's costly in terms of the national treasure. And I think
you're absolutely right. Well, I worry when I hear the President of the United States talk about fire and fury without previously reviewing the statement with his generals or his advisors. I think we're going down a very dark path where we need clear-headed, consistent, and calculated thinking. And instead, we have someone who's driven by emotion and by pettiness and ego. And I think that's going to have potentially devastating consequences if we can't control him.
Donald Trump pulled out of the Paris Accords and called global warming a hoax. Now, I understand that you were so concerned about Darrell Issa's unwillingness to acknowledge the threat of global warming that you sent Representative Issa a book called Climate Change for Beginners. I might argue that a better book might have been Climate Change for Dummies and the Willfully Ignorant. But, you know, we may be splitting here, so I'm going to demur on that point. The League of Conservation Voters has condemned ISIS's actions related to the environment, stating that, quote, as chairman of the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, Congressman Issa is not only denying climate change, but also actively impeding federal action, pledging to hold hearings on the politicization of science and calling for greater oversight of the EPA's regulations of greenhouse gases. Now, during your campaign, how will you deal with climate change deniers such as Congressman Daryl Issa, and in dealing with Donald Trump, a man that also believes that climate change is a fabrication?
Well, you know, during the last election, I don't think we spent nearly enough time talking about climate change, either at the local level in this campaign or at the national level. I feel like it's one of the great differences between our respective political parties. And when you have someone like Trump who says that climate change is a hoax perpetrated by the Chinese in order to undermine, you know, U.S. competitiveness, I can't fathom that he actually believed that. But Daryl Issa, you know, presumably is a smarter guy. He has, you know, 30-some-odd patents and knows a thing or two about technology, at least he claims to. And
well,
yes.
But he did cut his teeth and make his money in, if I believe that I'm correct on this point, is that it was on car theft prevention devices.
Yes.
And he brought a wealth of personal knowledge to that, and I understand he'd been arrested several times for automobile theft.
I'll let your listeners Google. Rather, Daryl has a history of suing people, so I'll let your listeners Google it. But yes,
well, good. You know, he can sue me, and
there you go.
You know, if he sues me, he can just take over my debt. So, you know, good luck with that.
No, you know, I think at the end of the day, I tried to have some fun at the beginning of the campaign by sending him a book intended for a fourth grade reading level with pictures, you know, 150 pages, which just, you know, very basically outlined what anybody who can, you know, read at a fourth grade level knows, or anybody who can even watch a 2-hour documentary knows, is that 97%+ of the scientific community overwhelmingly for, you know, decades now has known that man is contributing to a changing climate. And if we don't put a stop to it, it may have irreversible effects. And, you know, as profoundly obvious as that is for anybody who believes even the slightest bit in science, for these folks like Issa and Trump to deny it just shows that it's really who is funding their political campaigns, their political ascent. Particularly Issa, when you take a look at his FEC reports, you see that roughly half his funds are coming from big corporations, big corporate PACs with ties to the fossil fuel industry. So it's no wonder that he's trying to defend them. So what do you do? Well, you continue to call out the fact that he represents a coastal district, wants offshore drilling, doesn't believe in basic climate science, believes that we're still unsure of the extent to which humans are causing, you know, carbon-related warming. And so at the end of the day, you just expose him as a hypocrite, as a fraud. And you also talk about the importance of a proactive measure at the state and federal level to deal with the carbon pollution and ultimately to try to begin to reverse the climate crisis that we face. All you can do is keep talking about it every single day. I've dedicated my whole professional life to a cleaner environment. It's one of the great passions of my life. It's one of the reasons I decided to run, as I thought not only could I talk about it persuasively along the campaign trail, but if I'm so fortunate to serve, I could actually do something about it again on day one, no on-the-job training needed.
You're so much kinder than I am. Your instincts are so much better, I suppose, politically, because what? I look at this as either willful ignorance or a sign that somebody is beholden to special interests in the oil and gas industry.
Correct.
Because there's so much evidence that it just seems to me, Daryl Issa, let's be fair to the gentleman. He's not stupid. He is an intelligent person.
Yes.
So for him to take the kind of position on global warming and greenhouse gases, there has to be, you have to scratch a little bit below the surface.
Well, you know, Daryl Issa is very good at articulately saying a lot without saying much of anything at all. He's good at, you know, long statements on a variety of policy issues that when you just boil them down have very little content. So I look forward to, I hope I have the opportunity a year from now to debate the man. I think it would be really, really fun. And I don't think he's been pressed the way that I would press him on a variety of issues.
Good. Well, let's hope that he has an opportunity to do that, takes up the opportunity, and really gives the voters of your district, the 49th Congressional District here in California, the opportunity to hear from those who seek to represent them so they know what they truly stand for and believe.
Well, usually if we want to see him, you know, we catch him up on the roof of his building. you know, taking photos of us below, calling us paid protesters. That's about the extent of constituent interaction I've had with the man.
Wonderful. I just want to remind everyone you're listening to Laguna Roundtable on KX93.5 FM. I'm Dr. Ari Grayson. My guest today, Mike Levin, is a candidate for California's 49th U.S. Congressional District. Now, one of the things that has impressed me about you as I read through some of your personal story and professional background is that you don't just talk the talk, especially when it comes to environmental responsibility. You started an Orange County trade organization for clean energy, part of the clean energy industry. You're on the board of California's Hydrogen Business Council. And here's the kicker, as far as I'm concerned, you drive a zero emissions vehicle, a hydrogen-powered car. As many of our regular listeners know, I recently had the opportunity to purchase, well, to get one as well. You can't purchase them, at least not the one that I got. You can only lease
it. Yeah, you'll be able to purchase them soon, though.
I absolutely love my hydrogen fuel cell car, so I'm definitely with you 100% on that. My Honda, the Clarity that I've got, it's beautiful, it's quiet, and it emits only water vapor. And it does, it's kind of cool in that it's always attracting attention, and people are constantly asking me questions about the future of hydrogen technology.
Yep.
So I think your answer to this next question is going to be something very valuable to people who are thinking about making that next step in their own personal life and trying to be more environmentally responsible to reduce their global carbon footprint. As a congressperson, what can and what you be doing to help ensure that there's expanded production of zero emission vehicles, and what can be done to help ensure that we have a national network of fueling stations selling hydrogen at a market competitive price?
Well, you know, just like you, Ari, I love my hydrogen car, and I think the only difference is that you have the white one and I have the red one, but they're a fantastic car for people that want a zero emission vehicle, but also don't want the range anxiety, and also the refueling time is really, really good. A hydrogen fuel cell electric vehicle is just another type of EV, and you know, really, the key is getting renewable fuel for all types of electric vehicles. You know, for a battery electric vehicle, that means getting renewable electricity to be able to charge the car in a sustainable way. For a fuel cell car, that means getting renewable hydrogen. The good news is that we've got lots and lots of low cost renewable power that can serve both purposes. You know, the renewable power can charge a battery. It also can be electrolyzed. What that means is that you basically split water with that electricity that creates hydrogen, and then that hydrogen can be used in a fuel cell EV. The challenge for the cost of hydrogen has been economies of scale. And I think now that we have a lot of extra renewable power out there, I think we'll be able to have lower cost fuel for both battery electric vehicles and for fuel cell electric vehicles. You know, I've been part of the effort to help grow this network to 100 stations in California. I think we're at around 30 or 40 right now. We'll have 100 stations by 2020. And there are a lot of great local companies that are working on this. UC Irvine, through the National Fuel Cell Research Center, a great startup company called First Element Fuel that has the True Zero network of stations. Those folks are good friends of mine. And I think, look, you know, the range and the filling benefits of fuel cells are constantly being pushed by the battery EVs, and that's a good thing, you know. And I think the key is from a federal level that we support all forms of electric vehicles and deploy them. You know, we need a nationwide fast charge network, not just for Tesla, but for all EVs, and we need a commitment to reduce the greenhouse gas emissions of our transportation fleet, which is why it's so concerning to see the renewable fuel standard being attacked, and you know, no discussion of any sort of renewable portfolio standard or a target zero emission vehicles. So I applaud what we're doing in California. I think we need to follow that model around the nation. And as a member of Congress, I'd be committed to finding bipartisan solutions to do just that.
You know, I love the fact that we do have a company like Tesla out there with their zero emission vehicles. We understand what some of the limitations are right now in terms of the charge time, but they're working on that. I also love the fact, to be quite honest with you, is that Tesla was born out of, you know, right here in Northern California.
Yep.
And so my next question to you is, how do we ensure that California maintains its leadership role in constructing hydrogen fueling stations, and that we're the leader in creating new jobs in this burgeoning industry? And what type of jobs might that be specifically?
Well, again, you know, we are the leader with about 30 or 40 stations today, thanks to a partnership between the public and private sectors, which is really led by the California Energy Commission and the California Air Resources Board. And the governor's office. Governor Brown has been very supportive. You know, you also need private industry, and we've got several of the vehicle makers like Toyota and Honda and Hyundai and others that are bringing these great products to market. You've also got a lot of the companies in the hydrogen fueling infrastructure and station business that we've mentioned. And I talked about True Zero a minute ago. That's a startup company, but also other companies. There are a lot of jobs that are engineering jobs. They're high-skilled, high-wage, and I think that there are examples of the type of STEM jobs that we'll have, you know, in our country growing and growing, and that's to really keep our position of global leadership. You know, right now in our district, the 49th District, 22% of the jobs are in science, technology, engineering, and math, and the problem is that too many of those jobs are white-collar and not enough are blue-collar, and I see our area going through, you know, a certain amount of deindustrialization, just like so many other parts of the country. But I think we're better positioned than most because of these new industries like clean energy, like biotechnology, like life sciences, where we're able to compete and win in a global market for technology and for the cutting edge. So my hope and my expectation is that I can bring the kind of policies back to the district again. Job creation should be a bipartisan effort, and I think that we can do a whole lot of good for creating the jobs of the future.
I just want to remind everyone you're listening to Laguna Roundtable on KX93.5 FM. I'm Dr. Ari Grayson. My guest today, Mike Levin, is a candidate for California's 49th U.S. Congressional District. Speaking of the jobs of the future, we're not going to have those well-paying jobs without having a well-educated population. Just outside of your district is the University of California at Irvine, one of the top 10 public universities in the United States. You also have directly in your district the University of California at San Diego, another one of the top public universities in the nation. What can or what should we be doing to ensure that our students with the ability to succeed have access to a top-tier university? Because as we know, education here has gotten so expensive that parents are worried and wondering how they're ever going to pay for their son or daughter's schooling.
Well, you know, right now we have a Secretary of Education who doesn't believe in public schools. Simple as that. And I'll fight the Trump administration's desire to privatize public education. You know, if we're to succeed in a highly competitive global economy and have the best educated workforce in the world, public colleges have to be available to working families. And we have to substantially at the same time reduce student debt. So, you know, there are a lot of efforts out there. I support the College for All Act that was introduced by a lot of different senators and House members, including Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and others. And, you know, it would eliminate tuition and fees at four-year public colleges for most families. And it would also make community college tuition free for all, you know, and it's paid for with a speculation tax. So it's a small tax on the stocks and bonds and derivatives, and many of those are high-frequency trading that you very easily could put a very small speculation tax on. That's the current proposal, how you'd pay for it. As far as student loans and the student debt crisis, you know, as I mentioned before, you know, I wound up graduating from law school and going into a law firm years later when I had to pay off my own six-figure student loans. And I'm really encouraged that this same College for All Act would cut all interest rates for new borrowers in half, and existing borrowers would be able to refinance their loans based on the interest rates that are available to the new borrowers. And in the case of undergrads today for the federal loans, it's less than 2%, because the student loan business should not be making the federal government any money. You know, we have to get student loan debt under control. Otherwise, we're just, you know, we're putting a straitjacket on somebody to be able to make the choices that they want to in their career. When they get out of school, they ought to be able to do whatever their heart and mind sets them out to do without worrying about being so deeply in debt that they're, you know, going to be 50 or 60 years old before they pay off their student loans.
And that does provide a real anchor around the students who are really providing our next generation of engineers, doctors, lawyers, professionals of all sorts. So I think that's certainly wise. A person who is making $40,000 a year is not contributing nearly as much to the tax base as somebody who's making $75,000, $80,000 a year.
Exactly, yeah.
And we all have a vested interest in that. It's, as you know, I've said countless times that, you know, even if you don't have a child in public school or you've never had a child, so certainly you didn't have one go through the public school system. You know, if you're 80 years old living in a senior living facility somewhere within the district, you want to know that the next generation of engineers is going to be working in the field of biomedicine and creating that next generation of hip replacement. You want to know that somebody is working at the Stem Cell Research Center here at UCI Medical so that we're looking at cures for Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, and so forth, improving the quality of life for everybody. So it would seem that that is one of the things where we can't expect businesses to step in.
Yep.
But as a society, we have a vested interest in one another, in making
yep.
sure that we each have an opportunity to be the most powerful as we can be in contributing to our society and our economy.
Yep, totally agree.
I'm going to shift gears just a little bit here because healthcare has been on the minds of just about everyone these last few months. In May, the Republican delegation in the House of Representatives passed a bill that the Congressional Budget Office said would make health care unaffordable for millions of people, particularly people with pre-existing conditions. But at the same time, that bill would give a huge tax break to the top 1% of the country. Congressman Daryl Issa favors repealing the Affordable Care Act, and in fact, Congressman Issa voted to approve the health care bill that in January of 2017, Issa cast the tie-breaking vote to approve Trump Care. After that bill was passed, Donald Trump called his fellow Republicans over to the White House to celebrate their approval of the bill. But later on, Mr. Trump turned around and said that the very bill that Daryl Issa voted to approve, Donald Trump called mean-spirited.
Yep, which was really being actually very nice because it was...
I thought it was very kind, especially
yes.
knowing so many seniors in our area here and you know how much they depend on the healthcare system in order to make sure that they can live a healthy and productive life. So what do you think healthcare should look like here in the United States?
Well, I think this will be one of, if not the defining issues of the 2018 election. And I couldn't have a larger difference of opinion from Daryl Issa. You know, he actually said the other day that the Affordable Care Act was Stalin-type socialism, his words. And I think that we have to work towards universal coverage. I believe single-payer is the most efficient and effective means to do that. At the same time, I think we have to work to repair and strengthen the Affordable Care Act. And I think when President Trump says that the Affordable Care Act is going to implode or that he wishes it to implode, I actually see it as a violation of the Constitution. You know, Article 2 says that he has to take care to uphold the laws as passed by Congress, and I don't think he's doing that. I think he's creating all of the uncertainty or a lot of the uncertainty in the marketplace right now. You know, the question is then how can we fix the Affordable Care Act? Well, I think we need to advocate for a public option. I think we need to provide the opportunity for people who are 50 or 55 to be able to buy into Medicare. And I think we need to hire a new full-time federal enrollment assistance group to help more people enroll. In general, I think we have to defend Medicare and Medicaid. We've got to ensure that young people can stay on their family's health insurance plan. We've got to oppose any discrimination against people with pre-existing conditions. And we've also got to ensure that our veterans get the care and benefits that they have earned. You know, this is an incredibly important issue. And it's very, very hard to fake not having health insurance. You know, this is not fake news. These are not alternative facts. You know, I speak to people across our district all the time that are going to be dramatically impacted by this. Remember speaking to a 64-year-old woman who makes around 30 grand a year working at a bookstore, doesn't get health insurance through her employer. She's on the exchanges, and the estimate is that her health care would go from the current $1,700 a year in premiums that she pays to $16,100 a year, nearly tenfold increase. That will make it impossible for her to live in Southern California, given all the other costs that we have. So this is something that, you know, I think if we can expose the Republican plan and talk about it in a way that resonates with working class voters, we're going to do very, very well in 2018.
Well, and it would certainly seem to me to be a nonpartisan issue. We all have health issues. It doesn't matter whether you're Democrat, Republican, independent, or not affiliated, because you really don't even care about politics. It affects everybody. It's part of the human condition. But while we're on the topic of health care, I did want to make sure that we discuss women's health. Daryl Issa was rated 0%. I kid you not, 0%.
It's hard to do.
Well, it truly is. And, you know, to receive a 0% approval by the National Family Planning and Reproductive Health Association is no small task.
Yeah. I mean, he even got a 4 out of 100 on the environmental stuff. So, you know, and I'm still trying to figure out where he got that 4, but he got at least a score of 4 out of 100 on women's reproductive rights and so forth, a 0. So I think we should go from a 0 to a 100. What do you think?
I think that, and we might have to change trains along our route in order to achieve that, because we know that that's not going to come from Daryl Issa. My question to you is this: is it an appropriate use of taxpayer dollars to fund and support Planned Parenthood? And what role, if any, should Planned Parenthood play in women's health care?
Well, it absolutely is an appropriate use of taxpayer dollars. You know, I'll always fight to protect a woman's right to reproductive choice, to health care. You know, folks like Daryl Issa, they talk about defunding Planned Parenthood. Some of them even want employers to decide whether women can get access to birth control. And I think that, you know, frankly, politics and politicians have no place in these decisions. You know, they should be left to a woman, her family, in consultation with her doctor. And, you know, Planned Parenthood is serving over 2 million women. Many of them are folks with low incomes that don't have health insurance, and they rely on public health care funding. And, you know, you can't use federal funding for abortion. I think it's important that people know that because of what's called the Hyde Amendment. So attempts to block these patients from getting care at Planned Parenthood only keeps them from getting preventative services like birth control and cancer and STD screening, in many cases that are saving lives. So I think all of this is fairly ridiculous, and I do everything I could to support a woman's right to choice.
And I think a lot of people are unaware of the fact that they also provide men's health services as well. This is not just the purview of women or services that are provided to women, but men can go in for testicular cancer testing and so forth. I'm going to try and have somebody here from Planned Parenthood in so that they can talk a little bit more knowledgeably about the specific services that are provided to both men and women among us. But, you know, again, healthcare is not just, you know, a Democratic issue. It affects everybody. It affects our Republican brothers and sisters as well.
That's right. And, you know, we have to realize that as a society, what's bad for women is bad for men. And it's bad for our families, and it's bad for our country.
No question about it. So thank you for that. We just have a little bit of time remaining, so I would like to wrap things up by asking you a couple of questions that concern the United States on the world stage. And I would be remiss if I did not mention the red elephant in the room, Russia. Donald Trump has been embroiled by controversies and now investigations into his relationship with Russia. Your opponent, Daryl Issa, supported Trump's dismissal of FBI Director James Comey because of his efforts to investigate Russian involvement or potential collusion into the 2016 elections. Do you agree with the U.S. intelligence agencies and the Director of National Intelligence that Putin led a Russian effort to hack and to interfere in the United States elections, even if he did not specifically hack into the election booths or ballot boxes themselves and change votes, but tried to influence it through information that was being put out there?
Of course. And, you know, I think anybody that's reasonable knows that that happened. I'm very honored that Congressman Adam Schiff was the first member of the House of Representatives to endorse me in this campaign. And I think he has been an example of what a real watchdog looks like, as opposed to Daryl Issa, who is a fake watchdog. You know, what happened this past election was a fundamental attack on our democracy. They call it meddling, but the term meddling really doesn't do it justice. And it's very troubling that Trump is the only one left who doesn't admit that what happened was an attack on our sovereignty. I'm encouraged to see the grand jury, you know, to see the impaneling of a grand jury, because I think that the special counsel, Mueller, needs to be able to subpoena witnesses and documents And I don't think a grand jury would be impaneled if there was really no evidence or evidentiary basis to move forward. So I would be very honored to serve on intelligence if I got there. And I think concurrent with the work of Mueller, it's the responsibility of the House to continue and the Senate to continue its investigations to understand exactly what happened and to make sure that it never happens again.
Unfortunately, we're just about out of time. But before we go, I want to once again extend an invitation to Congressman Darrell Issa and his team. I have tried to contact them. I've spoken to them on the phone. I've sent them emails, but I haven't gotten any response. I would love to have them with me here on Laguna Roundtable.
Well, and you should ask him, Ari, if he would stand up to Trump on anything. You know, he called Barack Obama the most corrupt president in our history. He said Barack Obama had committed impeachable offenses. And now you have Donald Trump, who has committed possible collusion and obstruction of justice, and Darrell Issa says nothing.
It would be wonderful to be able to hopefully get him here into our studio. And I think it's especially important to the people of the 49th Congressional District to be able to hear the views and positions of a representative or a candidate directly from those who want to represent them. I think it's essential to having a healthy democracy. I think we need to demand it. We should demand nothing less. The voters deserve that, and it's a fundamental courtesy and demonstration of respect. So hopefully we can get Congressman Issa in here. As I say, I would love to talk to him directly and hear what he has to say. But for today, I want to again thank Mike Levin for joining me in the studio. So thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Ari. It was really a pleasure. I look forward to doing it again.
I would love to have you here again sometime perhaps in the spring or after the primary when you're officially into the general election. So
terrific. And, you know, if any of your listeners want to learn more about me, my website's just mikelevin.org. I encourage you to join our 60,000-plus followers on Twitter at MikeLevinCA or go to our Facebook page at Levin for Congress.
Thank you for mentioning that. So our listeners know what to do in order to learn more and to stay better informed. I do want to thank everyone for joining us today. You've been listening to Laguna Roundtable with co-host Jim Kennedy and Dr. Ari Grayson on KX93.5 FM. Our guest this week has been Mike Levin, candidate for California's 49th U.S. Congressional District. Please join Laguna Roundtable again next week. Until then, take care, everyone.
Meanwhile, back in the year one, when you belonged to no one, you didn't stand a chance, son, if your pants were undone. 'Cause you were brave for humanity and sold to society. One day you'll wake up in the present day, a million generations removed from expectations of being who you really want to be. Skating away, skating away, skating away on the thin ice of the new day. So as you push off from the shore, won't you turn your head once more and make your peace with everyone? But those who choose to stay will live just one more day to do the things they should have done. And as you cross the wilderness, suspending in your emptiness, you feel you have to pray. Looking for a sign that the universe on my hands has written you into the passion play. Skating away, skating away, skating away on the thin ice of a new day. And as you cross the circle line, well, the ice wall creeps behind, you're a rabbit on the run. And the silver splendors fly in the corner sun. Well, do you ever get the feeling that the story's too damn real and in the present tense? All and everybody's on the stage, and it seems like you're the only person sitting in